Let's say thank you to our friends for leading us in worship this morning. Thank you, friends. Appreciate it. Hey, have you ever wondered how some things like get their names? Like how are things defined? How do people come up with the things we call things? Maybe I'm the only one who walks around all day wondering that kind of stuff. Of like, oh, I wonder if there's a real word for that thing or for that thing or for that thing. Like, for example, I don't know if you've ever been walking, say, like in a parking garage or in a really tall building and you got to go up and down the steps, right? The other day I was walking through a parking ramp and I'm like, what do they call that landing in between the two pieces of stairs that go in opposite directions? Believe it or not, there's a word. It's called a half pace. So next time you're in a stairway and you come to a platform of a staircase where the stair goes the other, you know what that's called. Right? Or maybe you've always wondered, oh man, I wish I had a word for what the day before yesterday was. Well, guess what there is? It's the word nudistertian, right? Not nudist Martian, nudistertian. Seems a little easier just to say day before yesterday, right? But there's actually a word for that. Right, so now you can start using these words in everyday language. When you're having conversation, I'm sure it comes up all the time. You had no idea it was a word, but now you get to, so I'm sure you're really, really happy about that. Or my favorite, right? If you've ever wanted to know if there was a word that has something to do with, like, what's the word for, I don't know, pertaining to breakfast? Well, there's a word for that. It's the word gentacular, right? As in, wow, Mom, those are some gentacular eggs. Doesn't mean they're good or not, it just means they pertain to breakfast. Why do we have a word for things that pertain to breakfast? I don't know. Somebody at one point in life was a real fan of breakfast food. That's true. So gentacular, now you can go home and use that one too. Those are some things that I wonder, like how do things get named and defined in the words they use? How do those come about, right? What's more interesting to me is to think about this term in my own life, right? To think about these things in my own life. And in particular, where I've been thinking around as we start this new sermon series is, what does the word Christian mean? Like, what does it mean to be defined as a Christian, right? What does that word mean? What sets Christians apart? What defines Christians? What's distinctive about people who use that word, right? What does that mean? For most of us, it seems like an adjective. Right? It seems like that's a word you put before some other word, like that's a Christian church, or that's a Christian school, or that's Christian music, or a Christian book, or there's a Christian voter, or there's, you know, we use this as often as an adjective. But is that really true? Is that really what that all boils down to? Is it an adjective? Is it a qualifier? Well, we're in luck because we don't have to spend a ton of time thinking and making that up for ourselves, because the early church, in fact, spent a lot of time defining that word and defining what it means to follow Jesus. Beyond just the idea that a Christian is someone who believes in Jesus Christ, what is distinctive and definitive about them? The early church had an understanding about what made a Christ follower distinctive in the world. And in this series, we want to look at that. We want to pull that apart. We want to unpack that because it comes from three words in particular that may be really familiar to you if you've ever been to a wedding, right? It comes from these words. And out of 1 Corinthians 13, which is a real love kind of passage, it says, now these three things remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. These three things, faith, hope, and love. And while they might be familiar to you in this passage, you might be surprised that those three words, faith, hope, and love, show up all the time in the New Testament. They show up all over the place, faith, hope, and love. And if you want to know what it means to be distinctive as a Christian, it really lies in those three words, faith, hope, and love. And so over the next 3 weeks, we want to look at these threefold descriptors of what does it mean to be a Christian and actually figure out how does that get true in our own life? How do we live that? What does it mean to be a person and a people who are defined and marked by faith, hope, and love? Right? That's the question we want to ask. What does it mean to be marked by those three things in our families, in our own lives, in our country, in our workplace, in our neighborhoods? What does it mean to be people defined by that? For some of us, that might be a change in how you think about what does it mean to be a Christian, right? For some of us, we assume the definitive marker, the distinctive about being a Christian is church attendance, or maybe charitable giving, or maybe avoiding certain things or engaging in certain other things. We have these different markers of what we think it means to be distinctive. But it's not. It's these three things. God has laid this out in our scripture to talk about it in this way. So what does it mean to be a person or a people marked by faith and hope and love? And for those of you in this room, I'm not assuming that every single person in this room would even call themselves a Christian, would even care to be identified in that way. What I would love to have you consider throughout this series is, let's forget that word Christian for a moment, but what would it mean in your life to be marked by faith and hope and love? And let's just pull at that thread and see what happens. And today we want to start with the first one. Today we want to start with faith. Today we want to start with faith. And there's one place in particular that really unpacks this idea of faith. And it's a first century church called in a town called Thessalonica. And it's a place that the Apostle Paul, who wrote many of the books in our New Testament, in our Christian Bible, it's a place where he began a church. And he ended up writing a letter back to this church. And he wrote two, and called the 1st and 2nd Thessalonians in the New Testament. And there's a place where he writes to this church, this group of Christians in this town of Thessalonica in 1 Thessalonians 3. And this is what he says. So when we could not stand it, he has better grammar than I do, right? Could not stand it no longer. That's terrible grammar. I'm in a school. I should talk better than that. I should speak more well. I don't know. This is what Paul says. So when we could stand it no longer, we thought it best to be left by ourselves in Athens. We sent Timothy, who is our brother and co-worker in God's service in spreading the gospel of Christ, to strengthen and encourage you in faith, so that no one would be unsettled by these trials. For you know quite well that we are destined for them. In fact, when we were with you, we kept telling you that we would be persecuted. And it turned out that way as well, you know. For this reason, when I could stand it no longer, I sent to find out about your faith. I was afraid that in some way the tempter had tempted you and that our labors might have been in vain. So Paul plants his church. And then he leaves and he writes back to him. He says, we sent Timothy. I wondered about you. I was curious about you. I wanted to send Timothy to strengthen your faith. I also wanted him to kind of check on your faith. And if I read that, I'm like, I don't know what that means. What does that mean? What does it mean to go check on somebody's faith? What does it mean for Timothy to walk in that place and report back to Paul about the status of their faith as a community? What does that mean? What does that mean for us? To be honest, it's a struggle I have because that word faith seems really, really abstract, right? Like faith is something we have. It's something we can grow in. It's something we're supposed to pursue and have it at a deeper level. That word deep is often connected to faith. Is it, you know, Paul sent Timothy, is it something they could have lost or put on a shelf somewhere? What is faith? What does that word really mean? It's really difficult to describe to like a six-year-old, right? To really give a concrete definition. To me, it's like baseball, right? I don't know if you've ever tried to describe baseball to a six-year-old. Kind of hard. I took my kids to a Tigers game a summer or two ago, and they're not that into baseball. They don't watch it on TV. They don't play it, but we went to a Tigers game because we live in Michigan, and you should do that at least once in the summertime. So, you know, we went to a Tigers game. I had these great seats, like sixth row on the first baseline. You know, we could see all the action. If my wife wasn't so afraid of getting hit by a ball and doing this, she could have caught a foul ball. We would have gone home with a souvenir, but instead the guy next to her did. Right? We had a great time. But at some point early on, my kid starts asking me about like, well, what's happening out here, right? So he's like, what's the point? You know, like, how do we win? I'm like, well, you score runs. Okay, well, how do you do that? Well, you run around the bases. So just like any time you run, no, you have to hit the ball and then run to a base before they throw it there. Oh, okay, so that's how you get, so then how do you hit a ball when you left the bat? Well, then after that, like, if the other guy hits the ball, you can run, but only if he's like one base in front of you. You have to run. Sometimes you don't have to. Or you can steal a base when nobody's hit anything, and then you can do that. Okay. But also there's this thing called like outs. You get three outs in an inning. I'm not even going to go into an inning, but you have three outs. Well, how do you get out, right? Well, if you get three strikes, you're out. How do you get a strike? Is that when he swings and misses? Yeah, sometimes, right? Sometimes he doesn't swing and it's a strike. But if you get three of those, you're out. But sometimes, like, if you hit it and it goes over there, it's also a strike. But and you can also get on base if you just don't hit it and they throw four balls and then you can, it's really confusing, right? It's really, really confusing to explain baseball to kids. That's why I hope they just figure it out on their own, like I did, right? So yeah, faith for me is like baseball, really hard to define, but you kind of know it when you see it. You got to get it. You know what you're talking about. In fact, the best way I have found to think about how things like faith and hope and love all work together, the most concrete way I can explain it is through this way, to understand that love is a path, hope is a destination, and faith is the way you walk the path of love towards the destination of hope. Faith is the way you walk the path of love towards the destination of hope. And I'm going to pull at that over the next 3 weeks as we unpack each of these, but today we want to really zero in on this faith piece. Faith is the way you walk the path of love towards the destination of hope. And to get there, I want to look at a story in Genesis 12. I want to look at a story of a man named Abraham. You may be familiar with him. At some point in the book of Genesis, the very first book of the Bible, God has finished the creation stuff. Right? He's done with that piece of the narrative. So he's created the world and humans and generations have gone by. And God chooses one person on the earth. And he says, I'm going to build a holy nation and I'm going to be your God. And you, this group of people will be my people. And he starts with one guy. At that time, his name is Abram. God later changes his name to Abraham. And so he says to Abram, he calls him out in particular. And Genesis 12 is the beginning of that. In the very first verse, it goes like this. The Lord said to Abram, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. That's the very moment we are introduced to this man, Abram. It's the very beginning of his whole story. Abraham is known as the father of this faith. In fact, we give a name to Abraham, his son Isaac, and his son Jacob as the patriarchs of the faith because the entire faith nation came out of these three people and Abraham in particular. We have never once met Abraham until this very verse where God says, I want you to leave your country, your people, and your father's household. So that's interesting language, right? That's an interesting, leave your country, your people, and your father's household. It's an interesting way to call Abraham. He's actually calling him to move to a different country altogether to set up this nation. But he doesn't give him like geographic instructions, right? He didn't say, you need to leave your town, which was called Ur. He didn't say, I need you to leave Ur and go over here, right? He didn't say, I want you to leave the United States and go to Canada. He didn't say that, right? He didn't give him geographic instructions. Instead, I think what he was giving him was spiritual instructions, emotional instructions. Really, it's identity instructions. Because when you think about these three things, your country, your people, your father's household, your land, this place, leave this place, right? Our places cultivate our identity. I'm a guy who grew up here in Jenison and Hudsonville, Jamestown, right? I've spent my whole life here. Except for like 11 months in Columbus, but we don't count that for a lot of reasons, right? Sorry, Josh. Buckeye fan, right? But the place you are defines a little bit about your identity. It means something to you to be from West Michigan. It means something for you to live in the neighborhood, in the place you live. These things shape who you are. They help you understand your sense. I have this running joke with my wife because whenever we want to go downtown for something, right? Fridays are my day off and my wife and I like to have lunch and we often head to like the downtown market. We've been doing that for years. I don't know how to drive around downtown. I don't understand how those streets work together, but I could drive around Jenison, Hudsonville, or Jamestown and tell you, oh, I know people who used to live in that house or that neighborhood because it's part of who I am. Your place defines your identity in some ways. That's true for Abraham and his country. Or what about your people? Leave your people, right? Leave your relationships. Leave the people who are all around you, who have known you for your entire life, who know the stories about you. People help define who you are. People help shape the person you have become. Growing up, like my self-identity was often defined by the people who were around me, my friends in school. In high school, that was a big deal for me. They defined who I was as a person. And then in college, and even later as I grew up into ministry and took jobs in different churches, and the people who were around me helped shape who I become. And then your father's household, right? Your family, right? Your parents, your brothers, your sisters, your people and your immediate, your children, all of these people who are bound to you by blood have shaped who you have become. They have shaped your family system, your traditions, your hopes and your dreams and your values. And sometimes even your finances, right? If you were grown up, if you were raised in a wealthy family, that shapes part of your identity. If you were raised in poverty, it shapes your identity in a different way. So here's the thing. God is not just asking Abraham to leave a place. He is asking Abraham to leave an identity. He is asking Abraham to go from this place where he is that has defined who he is. He's asking Abraham to leave everything he knows about who he is behind. His whole identity, leave it behind. Leave your country, your people, and your father's household and go. Leave it behind. Leave your identity behind. Let go of what has shaped you. And if you're anything like me, I'm sure there are things in your life that have created you to become the person you are today. You might not know what they all are. You might not understand that living in this community has shaped who you are, that living amongst the people you have lived have shaped who you are, that your family has deeply shaped and cultivated the person you are today. They've defined how you think, how you talk, your job, your values, all of these things. So to let go of that feels almost impossible for many of us. What if God had asked that of you? All those things that have shaped you. And God said, let's move away from that. You're not left with much. But that's exactly what God asked Abraham to do. He says, let go of this security of who you think you are and go. He doesn't even tell him where. He says, go to the place I will show you. He doesn't even give him something on the front end. He just says, just let it go behind. Don't live in the past. That's the very first thing we know about Abraham. That is what God has asked him to do. But there's another piece to Abraham's journey. Let's go beyond that. Because if that's how it starts, it actually doesn't end much different. Abraham has his whole journey with God. He goes, he leaves all these things behind. He takes with him his nephew and some people and some servants and some livestock. And he becomes this really, honestly, wealthy nomad who's traveling around in the Middle East, and God continues to bless him, and his flocks grow, and his possessions grow, and he becomes a fairly powerful nomadic leader out in the countryside. And all through this journey, God's telling him, I'm actually gonna turn you into a great nation. I'm gonna turn you into a great people. In fact, God tells him again and again, your offspring will number more than the stars in the sky and the sands on the shore. So he's got this huge promise. The only problem is Abraham doesn't have any kids. And it's not until he's extremely old in life where he finally has a son, Isaac. His first and his only son. One son, that is it. And God keeps telling him, I'm gonna turn you into a great nation. So the fulfillment of this huge, almighty promise is all rested in the shoulders of this one, Isaac. And so then this happens in Genesis 22. Then God said, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah, which is a mountain in the Middle East. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you. Again, do you notice something interesting in the language? Take your son, your only son, whom you love, and go. Does that sound familiar in Abraham's story? Leave your country, your people, and your father's household and go. It's the same rhythm, right? I love this because in the Bible, words don't necessarily rhyme, but ideas do. Like God often rhymes things together and structures things in the same kind of way because there's something tying those things together. Take your son, your only son, whom you love, and go. Leave your country, your father's household, and your people, and go. Same rhythm, right? But let's back up a minute, because let's think about Isaac. Let's think about who Isaac is to Abraham, because, of course, he's a son, right? He's a biological offspring of Abraham. That's really important to him because of that. But there's more behind that. What does he represent to Abraham? In Genesis 12, we see this come out as God says, I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. All the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So Isaac is this first step to this promise. Isaac is the first step to a blessing for the entire nation. For all of the peoples in the whole world, Isaac represents this first step in that kind of blessing. And later on in Genesis 15, says this, then the word of the Lord came to Abraham. This man will not be your heir, but a son who is your own flesh and blood will be your heir. He took him outside and said, look at the star, at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. Isaac was not just a promise for the nation, it was a personal promise for Abraham. It was Abraham's singular vision of who he was to become. It's a personal future that you will bear a son and this is what he will do, right? And then in Genesis 21, Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Sarah, his wife, said, God has brought me laughter and everyone who hears about this will laugh with me. And so they named him Isaac, which means laughter. Isaac was a source of personal joy for Abraham and Sarah. And a grace that they experienced for God. It was a personal connection that they experienced to God, between them and God, with joy and grace. So Isaac was to be everything about Abraham's future. Abraham's entire future identity was wrapped up in the person of Isaac. Everything he was doing all throughout his story was looking forward to this moment, this son, and who he would become. And the whole world would be blessed through his family. Isaac was every part of Abraham's hope for a future, right? I don't know if you've ever anticipated something in your life. Maybe for you it was the birth of a child, or a wedding, or a job, or a move to a new home, or there's something in your life that you work towards. For many of us, I've been working towards retirement all of my life, and now I can see it on the horizon. These things in our life that we look for, and we start to find our identity is shaped by them. We've got two kids, but we feel like there's one more that God has for us, right? Or that these things that we look for and long for start to shape how we think about who we are today, right now. They shape our identity. They shape the person who we're becoming. So our identity is not just shaped by the past. It's also shaped by the hope of what we long for. It's also shaped by these things that we see in our future. Abraham had that too. And God says, take your son, your only son, whom you love, and sacrifice it. Go, lay it down. God asked Abraham to sacrifice his son. A traumatic event in and of itself, obviously, right? Obviously, there's that whole layer of that story going on. But remember what Isaac means to Abraham. This is more than just a relationship between a father and a son. This is a relationship between a man and his own identity and his own hopes for the future. Now, God stops him before this happens. He doesn't actually go through and sacrifice Isaac. But Abraham had to first be willing to give up that hope for a future. I don't know if you've ever had to lay something down that you were really hoping for, but that's what Abraham is dealing with in this moment. Sometimes it's the sacrifice of a future identity that's just as hard as sacrificing the things that have shaped us from our past. And for some of us, to give up on a dream, on a hope, to give up the ghost on something we're chasing is just as hard as leaving our people, our country, and our father's household. So here's what's really interesting to me about this story. What's really interesting to me in this story is that this person of Abraham is a huge focal point to the whole book of Genesis. 20% of the book of Genesis deals with Abraham. One guy. 20% of the whole book deals with one guy. And that book is the formation of not only the world, but of the nation of Israel, of God's people and his relationship to him. It's foundational. And 20% of it deals with this one guy. But the story ends for Abraham after the sacrifice of Isaac. That's it. We don't ever hear from Abraham again. We don't see what happens to him next. The only time we ever have him show up in Genesis is at his death and the death of his wife. So as the writer kind of wraps those stories up, but we never see any more narrative about Abraham. It takes on, it's all about Isaac and then about Jacob. So it's really interesting to me because if I look at the bookends of his story, I look at how God draws the line in between them about sacrificing his past, sacrificing his future, and sacrificing his identity throughout all of that. God says, I want you to leave something and go to the place I'll show you. I wonder if Mount Moriah was the place. I wonder if that was the purpose of his whole journey. I wonder if the purpose for Abraham's entire life was simply to learn to live right now. To allow right now and what's in front of him to shape who he was in his relationship to God. I wonder if the entire purpose of his entire journey was to let go of my identity from before and let go of my identity of what might become and learn to live in my identity with God now, today. Because if you let go of your past and your future, today is all you got. All you've got are choices. Right now, all you have are decisions you can make in this moment, right here, right now. Abraham's journey was for him to let go of the past and the future and maybe learn that. The Bible has a way to describe, to define what it means to live like Abraham. It's faith. That's the word the Bible uses to describe Abraham's journey is faith. That living in the moment, living about our choices right today, that's what faith is. In Hebrews 11, it says this, by faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son. In fact, this whole chapter of Hebrews starts line by line, and it says, by faith, Abraham. By faith, Adam. By faith, somebody else. By faith, another person. By faith, by faith, by faith. It names all of these people, these pivotal figures in the story of God's people. And when it says they lived by faith, it goes on to describe a choice they made, a thing they did. So when Paul sends Timothy to Thessalonica, and he says, I wanted to check on your faith. What he's looking at are the choices they're making, the way in which they are living. Because when you talk about faith, you're talking about choices. You're talking about actions. You're not talking about feelings. You're not talking about what you believe. You're not even talking about what you understand. When we talk about faith, we're talking about things that we do. And so when he sends Timothy back, he says, I want to see how you are living. Like, really? I want to see what choices. I was worried because persecution has come, and I was worried that the tempter might get you to live a different kind of way instead of living in a relationship with God where you're choosing to follow him at every moment. Because faith is a thing that you do. Faith is the way you walk the path of love towards the destination of hope. Sometimes we think about faith and we think about that faith is, that the opposite of faith might be doubt. It's not true. The opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is inaction, is doing nothing. Because faith is a thing we do. It's a way we live. It's a choice we make every day with what God has put in front of us. For some of us, we think faith is something that might happen to us. That if I just participate in something enough, that my faith will somehow grow magically. It's not. Faith doesn't happen to us. It's a choice we make every day in the way we live. That's why one of my favorite movie lines of all times comes out of The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien's massive work, where Gandalf says to the Hobbit, he says, all we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us. Faith is simply choice after choice. It's decision after decision. It's action after action. That's faith. So here's what I want to encourage you to do. I want to ask you this week to evaluate on a real simple level. Why do I do what I do? Right? It's a simple question that takes you in a lot of directions. Why do I say what I say? Why do I think the way I think? Why do I vote the way I vote? Why do I treat people the way I treat them? Why do I interact with my family the way I interact with them? Is there something in my past that's defining how I act today? Is there something in my future that I'm pursuing that's defining how I act today? And in that conversation, I want to simply ask you, what would it mean for you to let go of those things and to entrust your actions and your decisions to God in this very moment? In fact, I would love for you to make one conscious choice this week that you made on purpose because you thought God was putting it in front of you right now and you chose to react to it the way you think God would have you choose to react to it. That you knew for a fact that it wasn't some mystery that maybe God led me here or asked me this, but you knew. You had one decision, one sentence you spoke, one choice that you made, one action you took because you sat down and thought, I wonder what God would have me do right now about this. I had it this week where I was fighting with my wife, perhaps the only one of us who had that this week, but I was, and we were doing that thing where you're in the car, right? It's always because you're going somewhere and like something didn't work right at home. Maybe you did it on the way here. I don't know. No judgment. All God's children. It's okay, right? It's fine. So we're in the car doing that thing where we're just not talking, just silently having our own conversations in our own head, right? And so in my head, I'm doing that thing where it's like, here are all the reasons I'm right. All right, here are all the reasons why you're wrong. And in fact, I want to tell you all of these things, but I'm so frustrated. It probably will come out poorly, so I'm just not doing it. And we're just sitting in that stupid, awkward silence that's just making us even more mad, wondering who's going to go first, because then they lose, right? Again, maybe I'm the only one. I don't know. She doesn't even know that this is the thought process in my head because we've moved beyond it. But we moved beyond it because in my head, I had this thought. What would God have me do right now with what he's put in front of me? What would God do? What would God have me do right now with what he's put in front of me? What he's put in front of me right now is a stupid argument with me and my wife about not leaving on time. That's what he put in front of me. And I had to make a choice and say, what would God have me do right now? So I apologized and said, this is dumb. Let's stop fighting about this. Simple, really, really simple. But it was really important for me because I thought, I'm going to make a conscious choice right now to find out what God would have me do with what he's put in front of me right now. So I just want to ask you to do that once this week on purpose. Think about why it is you do what you do. Why it is you make choices the way you make choices. Is it something that has shaped you from before? Is it something you're longing for in the future? And maybe we can take a lesson from Abraham. Right? Maybe it doesn't have to take 20% of a Bible, of a book of the Bible to teach us something about living with God right now, because that's faith. It's the choices we make right now. And again, even if you're one of those of us in this room who would say, I don't know if I'm a Christian or not, I don't necessarily buy into that, that's okay. You can do this too. There's one action, one decision. God, what would you have me do with what you're putting in front of me right now? Let's pray. God, thank you for this time to be together today. Thank you for this story of your servant Abraham, who has created the foundation of a people and a family and a nation that we live into even today. God, for many of us, there are things in our lives that shape who we are and what we do, and we struggle with living by faith because it doesn't feel accessible to us, God, because we continue to make our decisions and our choices based on our own identities, God. Would you help us to rid ourselves of that, to step away from our own identity and instead make choices today based on how you are leading us? God, may we be people who listen to you, who decide to live by faith and make choices every day to follow you. In your son's name we pray, amen.